This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Stewart, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hey, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
Well, folks, we are excited to bring to you today the fourth and final episode, at least in this series, with Michael Hein. And we've been talking about shifting towards unorthodoxy. So this is the fourth of a four-part series. But for those that maybe didn't jump in on the very first episode, Michael, if you would kind of tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your background, and this new book that you've come out with that we're going to be talking about.
Sure. Be pleased to do that. I'm a general internist by training, got into healthcare executive leadership for a number of years, a number of different roles. And then here towards the end of my career, I serve as a full-time executive leadership coach with Medi Leadership. And I wrote the book because in the journey I've been on professionally now for 40 years I've worked in healthcare in various ways. An observation is that leading healthcare today is very difficult work. And I've always been curious, like, why is this so hard? I remember asking my own executive coach that, what makes this so hard? I mean, emotionally draining, physically draining, intellectually draining. And I was never satisfied with the, you know, the answers. Well, it's always been this way, or leadership is hard. I think those are truthful statements. But for whatever reason, I couldn't let go of that. And I have had a long curiosity about the implications for complexity science. You know, are our healthcare organizations complex? Complex systems, as we understand them, might have some answers for what makes this so difficult for us. And so that's really why I wrote the book, is I see human suffering. I see leaders suffering. I see our workforce suffering. And I think some of the reason for that is the way that we go about leading. And the way that we go about leading has to do with the way that we think and what we think about systems and what they really are and what our actions and behaviors and approaches as leaders will do or not do as we interact in these systems. So that's why I wrote the book. It's been super fun having this conversation with the two of you over the last several episodes. And I feel a little bit sad that this is the last of the pod series. I hope your listeners have enjoyed our banter as well and find the book interesting and worthwhile.
Yeah, Michael, we really appreciate it. I think it's timely, and it's been great dialogue. And even we often talk about this, but the conversations that we've had around the podcast before, after, in preparation for, have been really, really great as well. So thank you for your leadership in this. Today, you know, we've already talked about this, and I want to bring us to, you know, part four of your book in the name of our podcast, which is Connecting the Dots. I think is a great way to also say, How do we bring a lot of these themes and these mindsets that we talk about in your book, and how do we begin to connect the dots? How do we begin to put it all together to think about this that way? I'm curious if you'll start us off that way today.
Sure. I think what's coming up for me as I think about this is, you know, every day as leaders, we paint a picture of who we are and what we believe, and how we think and what we think leadership is meant to be. And over time, as people observe our approaches, actions, and behaviors, they create a narrative story. That's the picture that we're painting. And that's really what I tried to do in the last part, part four, was to say, okay, we looked at the mindsets that are attendant to an orthodox way of thinking about organizations and how best to lead them. And then we laid out and compared the unorthodox mindsets that would be aligned with our thinking around complex systems. And at the end here, I painted two pictures. I took every chapter, every mindset had three what I called expressions. These are patterned behaviors, approaches, and actions that we see as a result of the way leaders think, whether orthodox way or unorthodox way. So 10 chapters, 3 expressions for each, the orthodox and the unorthodox. So at the end, we have 60 expressions, 30 for the orthodox, 30 different ones for the unorthodox. And I just laid those 30 out, 30 different behavioral patterns, and described those. And it's a little bit redundant, probably, because we talked about them in the previous chapter. But to put them together as one and see the whole picture, I thought that was really illustrative about the difference between the Orthodox and unorthodox leader. Now, this is really interesting. Last week, I had the privilege of working with a group of senior executives, and we were talking about this very issue. And there was one of the leaders who admittedly was taking a provocative stance, he said. And he basically said to me, after we were talking about, why does this matter? Why does it matter whether we think organizations are complex or not? And I said, because it will change what you pay attention to. It will change your approaches. And that's really what the last part of the book is trying to say. Look, this is how you're going to look different. You're going to approach things differently because you're thinking through a complexity lens. That's what I attempted to do with the last chapter. It was fun to write. That was the easiest chapter for me to write of the whole book.
Expound on that. Why was it easy? Because, you know, I know we've also talked about the difficulty of kind of coming to a landing spot. So what made it easy?
It just flowed, I guess. Yeah. I think more the hard part for me writing the book was digging down deep into each of these mindsets and thinking carefully about them and trying to make a body of work that many professionals have spent their career doing in 6,500 words to make that accessible, especially for folks that really don't think in this space. And so it's unfamiliar territory. At the end, having done all of that work and then to synthesize that together, it's not only the work of writing the book, but I've thought about these things for decades. So it just kind of flowed out of experience and the writing. And I thought it was a nice way to write up I thought it was a nice way to end the book.
You said something there that it really has me thinking. And Skip, I'm going to kick it to you, because we talk about that everybody acknowledges complexity, right? When you say, you know, healthcare is a complex space, maybe the most complex socio-technical system ever created. And everybody kind of says, yeah, I agree with that. But then, Skip, what we see a lot is that people don't always show that in their thinking. Michael, you just said, you know, people aren't thinking about this. How do we get leaders to think about this more? Skip, I wonder if you'll kind of help me frame that question a little bit more to Michael.
Yeah, I really liked where you're going with that, Brad. And I'll even add a word because I know Brad, he meant to even add in that sentence. And that's how do we, in a respectful way, get people to consider some of the constraints and some of the parameters, you know, that are going on. So, for example, you'll see a lot of times people put in a particular system, some kind of very small subsystem, and they're wanting to execute on something. Maybe they're wanting the exchange of information between the physicians, the nurses, the other medical professionals, so that we can allow that patient's care to progress. You say, well, that's a good thing. No, it's a great thing, you know. But many times when you watch those systems and watch them fail, it's because they kind of broke some rules to systems thinking. Maybe they didn't have backups. Maybe they didn't have a standard. And so we get so excited to just, you know, kind of pull the metaphoric trigger of the gun and say, let's put this in. And then everyone's crying for the same thing. Everyone's saying, how do we get sustainment? If there's one question that gets asked at every conference, at every session I think I've ever been around, is this cry and desire to have sustainment. And it feels as if many times the reason that things don't sustain is because certain rules of physics, certain laws, maybe some might call them common sense, but certain things of a system, they just don't get put in place. Does that make any sense at all, Michael, or what's your reaction to that?
I think that this is worthy of quite a bit of discussion. And just listening to the language you're using, I notice rules and standard and almost like human beings, as whatever we put in place, we must follow those rules. We must interpret them, and we must follow those rules. That feels very mechanistic to me, Skip, as I'm listening to that. And I think one of the things that I'm paying really close attention to of late is that human beings, we don't follow rules. We can write a rule. It can be clear. We can have really good intentions to follow the rule. And that means I'm going to do exactly what I'm told to do, exactly the way I'm told to do it, in exactly the moment that I'm to do it this way, if we write a rule. The thing is, we all interpret the rules. And we interpret it based on the context that I'm in, plus our past history, our expertise, our experiences. And even though our intentions are to follow the rule, human beings will follow the rule, but that will introduce variation just by the very nature of human beings. We are not, like, if I look at complexity science, and they can simulate complex systems by creating agents in the computer system. And these agents follow simple rules. So there may be 3 or 5 rules that they follow. And we can demonstrate truly emergent behavior from these computer agents following simple rules. But the thing is, human beings are not agents like that. As much as we want them to be, as much as we believe that human beings just need more training, they need more clarity around policy and procedure. And that's efforts for us to try to standardize. I'm not saying that's not important work, but we can't go so far to think that human beings are rule followers. We can do our best, but it will introduce variation. So that's where my mind goes, Skip. And I don't know if that's what you were aiming at. It does bring up this point. Let's remember that when we're talking about systems and how they work, at the epicenter of those systems are human beings and the way that we interact with each other and the way that we bring our aspirations and our power and our ambition and our egos and our fears and our hatreds and our all the things that make human beings be what we are. When we're working in healthcare organizations, it is at the epicenter, at the core of that work, whatever kind of system we're talking about, it's about people and how they work together to get something done.
Really good. Really good, Michael. No, I think actually I loved your response. One of the best systems that I've ever seen created is when the leader got with the people that were going to partake in that system and asked a question, a couple questions. One question is, what do we want to accomplish? The other question was, how do we want to work together? You know, how would that look, right? I thought that from a group dynamics perspective, I thought that was really interesting. And today, there's pretty much not a week that goes by that Brad or myself will have some conversation. Maybe we may be having it separately. And someone may be telling us about a system that they have in place. And the simple question is, What do you hope to accomplish with this? It's not meant to be a sarcastic. It's meant to be a respectful question. I'm trying to understand, what is this thing trying to accomplish? More times than not, you'll hear people say, well, I'm not really sure. In other words, they've created something without understanding really what is that aim. But I think you're spot on, Michael, with always going back to that social element. You know, the other thing I would even add to that, and I'm interested in your response, is I remember Ed Schein always telling me, Skip, don't forget that you're not only dealing with a complex socio-technical system, but you're dealing with open systems, which is significantly different than a mechanical device, which is a closed system, right? What's your thoughts on that?
You're such an engineer, Skip.
Asking a question.
I was absolutely. I would take that language, open system, to me, where my mind, I translated that. Hopefully, it translated it. Remember, whatever you're doing, there's a context, a broader context in which you're trying to do what you're doing, and that broader context has significant play in what's going on. I mean, just look at legislative changes that are going on in our country right now. And those were maybe not fully anticipated or expected, or certainly has increased a degree of uncertainty. And they are real and they are impacting. I see it across the country in the leaders that I'm talking to every day. They are really impacting the work that's going on within a healthcare organization. So that to me is a great, very practical example of what I think you mean when you say, remember, it's an open system. That means there's not very clear boundaries here between what we're calling our healthcare organization, because the context, the payers, the government, the employers, the community, and quite frankly, the world and the geopolitical environment, all of that has impact on what transpires every day.
It makes me, you know, again, and trying to be informative to our guests and trying to, you know, I think a lot of folks take these and say, what can I do with that? How do I lean into this? I think your book does a great job of organizing that for our listeners. But I'm curious. I want you to answer that question. So we've got somebody out there that's like, yes, yes, and yes. This is complex. This is hard. This is dealing with people at all levels, internal, external, stakeholders that I may not have immediate kind of currency with to make a meaningful change. It's easy to just say, what in the world? It's easy to just almost want to lay down and say, it's too much. But we know we can't do that. So, Michael, help us. How do we lean into that? I mean, what does a leader need to do to get started, to recognize that how they show up and how they interact in this space?
Mm-hmm. The executive leadership coach in me would start by saying the beginning place for all of us is to notice how we're thinking and to be curious. Like, your mind cannot go to making sense of, well, what does this mean in my practical to-do list every day in a complexity fit way, if you have not stepped back and done the reflexive work about what are the mindsets that I'm already holding on to, and are those mindsets aligned with complexity? That's the beginning place. And the second thing that I would say, maybe in my view, the place for leaders to pay close attention is, what are you doing to try to control what is happening around you? To me, this notion about being in control is the probably the most significant and easy to notice thing that I would invite leaders to pay attention to, because in complex environments, our efforts to try to control things will fail. And when I say fail, I mean things will not go the way that we expect them to go. It increases our degree of anxiety, but it also diminishes the autonomy of the others around us, and it drives workforce burnout. So to me, there is a thread there of curiosity I would point to leaders. What are you trying to control? And is that the best and most useful approach? It should raise the question, I would hope, given the things we talked about in the book, about whether what I'm dealing with is a complex situation, context, problem, or organization, because reaching for control is just the opposite of what we want to happen. So, you know, that's the introduction. I said in the book, I think in the ending, in the afterword, I made a comment about it won't do in complex environments for me to show up and say, hey, these are 10 steps on how to be successful in a complex system. That in itself is a non-starter because your context is unique. That's one of the characteristics about complex organizations is the past does not inform the future. So if I brought some 10 steps how to, I'm doing you a disservice. The best thing I can offer is, as I did in the book, step back and notice what you're doing and be curious about what you're doing and ask yourself the question, is this a complex environment? So pay attention to control, pay attention to try to seek right answers. I think we talked about this in earlier podcasts, like notice your language. How often are you saying right, wrong, should? Those are cue words that you have a belief underlying those words that there are right answers to be found. And one of the key messages about working in complex environments is that right answers don't exist. There are many, many good answers, and we can experiment with those good answers. We won't know whether they're good until after we experiment with them and see how things turn out. So that's where my mind goes, is sort of a beginning place.
Well, you did my heart well by saying experiment. I really so thankful. And at the same time, the experiments are also socio-technical, aren't they?
Always.
Yeah.
I've gotten so sensitive to how we have a propensity in healthcare to dehumanize the work that we do. We talk about organizations. We talk about, you know, we'll say something like, well, the organization said this, or the institution needs that. I'm stopping my leaders and say, what do you mean by the organization needs that? There is no organization to need. It's people. What people? How many people? Why do you believe that there is a need for this in other human beings? And we have to be really careful that the more we talk about systems, I feel like the less we talk about people. Yeah. And that to me is the thing that's really complex within complex organizations are the human beings and the pattern relationships that are going on. And that's what makes it complex.
Well, Michael, I love that because and we kind of said this, but I think it bears repeating on air. You know, we come about this from different angles, but, you know, Skip and I through the Baptist Management System have spent lots of time and energy kind of. And the foundation is always people. And then we're working inside of systems. I love your push and your challenge for us around the mechanistic view of systems. I've been challenged by that. And I think that there's real value in, again, continuing to be curious as to how do you wrestle with that. But the reality, Michael, also is that we're still inside these systems. Even if we want to push back and say we don't understand them well or they're not the right mechanism to move into the future in a complex environment, all these things still exist today in organizations.
And let's remember, it's human beings at the center of those systems.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I in my journey, my professional journey, I spent years in the space of performance improvement, and I'm a big fan in the Toyota Management System. And it's one of the things that connected the two of you and me years ago was because of the work that you've done there. And I've been long been a fan of, if you will, Lean, to use a shortcut. However, I really believe today that the thing that makes Lean work is because it pays close attention to the human beings and the relationship and the ability and the trust and the psychological safety. So then you bring all the tools of Lean, if you will, on top of that. And it's a very effective way to be within an organization and to work together in ways that deliver better care, safer care. I absolutely believe that. But again, I've watched many healthcare organizations over the years strip out the social part, Skip, and just focus on the technical part and use the tool of Lean and talk about sustainability. I've never seen that work. I've never seen that work. And people will get all jazzed up about Lean, and in 3 years later, 4 years later, it's jettisoned or it's not even important, because I think they have forgotten or lost track of, it's about people and how we do our work together.
Spot on. There's so many places I want to go. Let's see if I can contain myself. I think you're spot on. I think you're absolutely right. And what was that word you used last week? You put a adjective in front of the word curious. How did you explain?
Let me explain that. I'll save the word for the client, but it does touch about this, keeping people at the center, you know, of what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
So I think all of us who have been educated and experienced in leadership for years, we learn early on the importance of curiosity, of listening. And curiosity, listening is really the manifestation of being curious. You know, how to do that? What are the physical signs, the way that I need to behave if I'm listening? You know, look people in the eye, lean in a little bit, nod your head, say yes, yes. And it's gotten to be, in my view, those become tactics to show that I'm listening. Anybody with a modicum of emotional intelligence, they will sniff that out in a second. They may not, like, they're doing everything. They're acting like they're listening, but I don't think they're really listening. Then this is the word that I use to say, let's get beyond this sort of tactical leadership skill set of listening and curiosity, and let's get to the root of what we mean by that. And I reached for the word reverent. Reverent curiosity means I see you, and I'm positioning myself as a student, and you are my teacher here in the moment. I'm hungry for learning from you about how you make sense of what's going on. And that, to me, puts the other human being in a place where you are reverent to them. It's not a common word used these days. And oftentimes, you know, it's tied to faith or religion. And we oftentimes think about that or use that word in regards to the deities that we might worship. But I'm applying it to human beings, the civility, the worthiness, because they're human. And because they're a human being, they are worthy of my reverence. In that moment, as I'm listening and generally curious about who they are, how they come to think the way they do, I want to learn from you. I think and imagine, what would it be like if more leaders were reverently curious with the key relationships that they engage with every single day?
Spot on. I think you nailed it, Michael. I think that's so important. And I've been using the word interested lately based off the work of Nancy Klein in Time to Think. But I think both of those words, you know, whether it be interested or reverent curiosity, really And here's my little litmus test I've been doing lately, like just my own. I can't believe I'm going to say this on air, but that's okay. Is I'll have a conversation with maybe someone that maybe their characteristics get on my nerves. Mm-hmm. Maybe maybe they're not the person I'm going to want to sit and talk about the St. Louis Cardinals or Alabama Crimson Tide. Maybe there's someone different. And I walk away and ask myself, Skip, how interested were you in them? Did they feel seen? Did they feel valued? They're somebody's husband. They're somebody's child. They're somebody's brother, you know. And so I really love this reverent curiosity because not only because they're worthy to be interested in, but also if you want to go back to the technical, because I loved your comment about, you know, Lean and Toyota. Toyota has some phrase about, well, we don't make cars, we make people, you know. And but, you know, I really love this idea of this reverent curiosity, because also what we have found, if you go truly to the problem solving kind of technical side of things, many times people know something, and what they know, you need to know to solve some major problem to improve patient care. But guess what? If you don't have that relationship with them, you're never going to find out what that is, because normally it doesn't come out till later, has been my experience. Later, after the relationship has been developed and they feel respected, they feel seen, they feel psychologically safe, they say something like, oh yeah, by the way, let me tell you what's going on there.
Skip, you just so beautifully articulated why the relationship is at the center of the work as we do as leader, and that ability to hear and speak and share so that our knowledge as leaders will grow. It is the characteristic of being in complex organizations where the leader needs to understand that they cannot know what is going on, what is all transpiring. There are too many interdependent relationships that are happening all the time in nonlinear ways. There's no way a human being, no matter how smart or brilliant they are, to understand and appreciate what is transpiring every day. That positions the leader to say, I need to know. And you can't know unless you're curious, and you're not going to get what you need if the other human being does not feel seen or heard, or the trust isn't there. And so reverent curiosity is a requirement for complexity fit leadership.
Hey, Michael, I love that. And so, you know, I've gotten the opportunity to get an advanced copy of your book. As we come to the end here, I want to give you the opportunity to share a little bit about, I know this is soon to be in print. Will you give us a little bit of preview of when the book's going to be released and how to get it?
Yeah, we're in the final stages. The book itself has been approved. They're finishing the jacket right now. So I would think in the next 30 days, it will be released. Available on Amazon and on the major bookstores if you're into that, and buy it online. So initially, we're going to have a hard copy and electronic copy available for folks that are interested in that.
Well, just to put in another plug, I would just say for healthcare leaders, this book really spoke to me. It really helps outline some of the things that we've talked about in these podcasts, the complexity that we face every day, sometimes the hard to put a definition on why this work is so challenging, it's so difficult. Michael, this work is going to be has been really influential for me, and will continue to be kind of in our short list of things that we think leaders need to hear, need to read, and need to understand to be effective in the healthcare space today. So thank you for your time. Thank you for this work. Thank you for the dialogue with us. We hope that we can continue that.
Me too. And it's been a privilege. It really has been.
Thank you so much, Michael. We so appreciate you.